Welcome, dear listeners, once again to Food Conversations Season 9. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Squamakulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Squamak people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. As we close out Season 9 of Food Conversations, we're bringing back two hardworking and central figures in the Shuswap Food Action Society. As most listeners know, this program is part of the work of the society. Both have been on our show before, and both have a lot to tell us about what's happening these days with the Shuswap Food Action Society, because there's a lot going on. Mary Rodriguez is the Society's School Meals Coordinator, and Melanie Bennett is its Project and Volunteer Coordinator. Both roles are pivotal to the work of the Society. Welcome once more, Melanie and Mary, to Food Conversations.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Delighted to have you here in the studio. Now, I was thinking before we started to ask each of you how long you actually have been formally involved with the Society. So Melanie, as the senior involvement person, do you want to say, when did you first
formally? Well, I mean, I began back in 2017. You know, I just started going to board meetings, just kind of sitting in and listening and hearing what was happening. Mm. That was when John McLeod was still president. And, you know, Serena got involved at the same time. We started as just interested members. Mm-hmm. And then it just became like, okay, what skill could we offer? What could we do? And then you just sort of volunteer and you give your skills and you do the different things. And it's just morphed into, at this point now, officially now, we are, you know, no longer even contract workers. We're actually on payroll now. We are with the CRA. We've got to do all the right things. So.
Ooh, that's exciting to graduate to the world of the CRA. Mm-hmm. Mary, what brought you into this fold, and when did that happen?
I actually was asked this question a few days ago, so I had some time to think about it. I think it's been about 4 years now. When we first moved here, I met Serena. We had some mutual friends, and so she thought I might be interested, and I started by attending board meetings. And then I officially became a board member, and that sort of morphed into me doing some cooking classes the first year. And then I kind of slowly got pulled into it more and more until I started working at Zest as well with the team. And now I'm, as you said, the school meal coordinator.
Now it's too late for both of you. You're definitely committed. What does spring, which is what we're experiencing right now, what does that do to the work that each of you are doing? Melanie, what kind of an influence does this season of growth and expansion in Mother Nature, what does it have on you?
Well, it's garden season.
It's garden season.
So it's the spring is the time of renewal and growth. So certainly it's everything is about, on my end of things, is the garden programming and getting, you know, those kinds of things going. The continuation of my role still continues with marketing and communications. So that, you know, comes from through the winter with Coldest Night right into what we're doing now and just trying to make sure that we're following the stories of everybody else who's doing the work. So, but for the most part, primarily spring for us is growth and the gardens.
Now, Mary, for you, it's approaching the end of the school season. Does that obviously is going to change the trajectory of your activities too?
Yeah, for us right now, it's actually picking up quite a bit and it's very busy more on the admin side of things because we're having to figure out the schedules for next year and what the budget looks like and trying to coordinate all of that. It's also for us a time when a lot of the farmers are sold out of most of the root crops that we've been enjoying for the whole winter.
The winter stores.
And yeah, of course. And now we're looking into the things that are coming out of spring. Like Mel said, there's like the greens and the
salads,
radishes and turnips and different things that we can purchase already. So we've been incorporating that into the school meal program and it's been great.
So looking back over the last year for each of you, Mary, what is changed over the last, say, 12 months, roughly speaking, from your perspective in terms of society's activities and your engagement?
For the school meal programs, like it just really continues to grow all the time. There's different streams of funding that come into play, which is great. There's different schools that have been sort of selected and by the school district as priority schools, schools that might need a bit more assistance with healthy meals for kids. Mm. So with those schools, we've been able to grow those programs, sort of looking into the next year and seeing what we're able to offer. So some schools that were previously only getting one meal per week are moving up some quite significantly, even potentially to every day. Other ones, we're sending like different lunches that they can heat up on different days when there's no food
delivery. Is that notion of so far constant expansion, how does that feel? Is it intimidating or exhilarating or a little bit of both or something else?
Yeah, a little bit of both for sure. Like in our organization, we definitely have some people that always have like the big vision and the big dream. And then sometimes we're scrambling along behind and trying to keep up with that, trying to like form our own dreams while sort of like doing things on the ground. So, I mean, it's a lot of fun though, right? Like the growth lets us try different things. We're trialing different recipes and, we started doing some breakfast items that we hadn't done before, lots more casseroles because they can just be thrown into the oven by somebody at the school and reheated, you know, at recess time. And then hopefully by lunch, it's hot and ready to go for the students that might need extra food for lunch.
So Melanie, are you one of the big thinkers or are you just trudging along with all of the tasks that come flying at you from all directions?
Yeah, I would be both. I'm definitely a dreamer. I think about the things that I'd like to see us do, but I'm also very grounded in reality of what we can accomplish with, you know, the funding we have, the people that we have. And I think this year there has been a great growth in the school meal programs for certain. I would actually say that our growth has remained fairly steady in this past year. And that's more because we want to get better at everything that we're doing. Mm-hmm. And we're at a level right now that we have to make sure all of our systems are in place. So it's kind of like the boring stuff. It's like the paperwork, the admin, but it's all so important. And we want longevity. We want sustainability. We need to make sure that all this work, and you said we're now like we're lifers, we're in there. We feel we care about this organization. Yeah. We feel passionate about it. And we want to make sure that it has longevity and that it will withstand if we move on, if we do anything else, other people need to be able to fill in these positions. And that requires all the documents.
Yeah. And that's such an important thing to do is to sort of consolidate. It's fine to advance and expand, but once in a while you have to sit back and make sure that the systems are all functioning and in place. Mary, let's get into the school food system a little bit, because is an expanding area. I mean, I have difficulty keeping up with it as an outsider watching, because every time I hear about it, there's more going on. Over the past year, you're expanded now. The numbers I have here, which might be even out of date, you're 14 schools expanding to 27. Even if that's approximate, that's a doubling essentially. And then the number of meals that were prepared is astonishing, 45,000 meals. That's the number. Got that off the website, so it's got to be true.
I think that was actually your number from last year.
Oh,
so
my
I just
God.
Checked numbers before I came in, and as of the end of last month, we're at about 72,000 meals, and we'll probably be at about 90,000 by the end of June.
That's in a 12-month period, or like a whole school year?
School year.
Yeah.
From September.
That is a doubling.
That's not 12 months. That's 8-9 months,
yeah.
Right?
It's the school year, yeah. which is a shorter. That's an astonishing number of meals. Do you feel as astonished as I feel, or are you just so used to it, Mary?
I think I'm not a huge numbers person. Like, I love seeing people's reactions and talking to people, so I always write the numbers down so that I can share them with other people. Does it sound like a big number to me? I honestly, probably not until we go to, you know, conferences and listen to other organizations. And then I'm like, oh, okay, wow, we are doing quite a bit.
So do you ever have a chance that you're frantically busy and just barely keeping up? Or is it that you really do have a pretty good grip on the processes of production and delivery that you can...
I think I should...
two of you looking, exchanging a smile.
For sure. I think I should extend an invite to you to come in to Zest and experience a day there with us. I mean, yeah, it's always really busy, right? We have a really tight deadline for when we have to have things ready at Zest and go out to the schools. Like, we deliver all the way out to Sorrento on one side and Armstrong on the other. So you basically need to have the food ready at 10 o'clock to be leaving. And then, you know, that doesn't factor in like snow in the wintertime or all these road closures with all the road construction, all that kind of thing. So yeah, of course, it's very fast paced at Zest, but with the timeline, I'm not you know, unless we want to start earlier and earlier in the morning. And I think we're
what
happy.
Time do you start?
Between 7 and 7:30.
Okay. Yeah. I won't feel really sorry for you yet, but I may have to one day in the near future.
No, she came to my house the other day to pick up some items to take to Zest with her, and I was still in my pajamas.
And what time was it?
That was 7:30.
Okay. The couple of the features in the program are the super meals aspect. Why don't you describe what that means? Of course, for listeners, that spell S-O-U-P-E-R. Soup.
I guess it's just a play on words that Serena, when she filled this role, came up with. She's really great at coming up with like different ideas that are appealing to kids and fun. And there's been art projects that have gone along with that from different schools as well.
It's basically
not just soup
it's
anymore.
It's not just soup. No, we've kind of changed it so that it's still the play on words, so that it's like super, but not just soup anymore.
Hmm. So what's
still
included
a lot
now?
Of soup?
It is still a lot of soup. Yeah.
But what else goes along with the soup?
So the entrees that I had talked about. We have a great collaboration with a lot of people in the community. Inspired Breads, of course, makes the buns that come with our things, mm-hmm. our meals, and Food and Forest Fixation actually stepped up and they're able to help us out with different things now. So we really appreciate that. They're making some English muffins for Jackson. They're making some focaccia. We've tried some pizza in the schools. They've made some gluten-free buns and gluten-free items for us, which is really great as well. So, and they've also trialed a breakfast cookie with the schools.
What's a breakfast cookie? I don't know if I had one.
So it basically takes a lot of healthy ingredients and kind of like forms it into a shape that kids will think is fun.
They think it's a cookie, yeah, but they're eating healthy food.
Yeah.
Oh, such trickery. I was looking at the menus and what's on it. And the soup is really quite a variety. Chicken enchilada, minestrone, bacon corn chowder, hamburger soup, stone soup, the famous stone soup mm-hmm. from the coldest night of the year. Chicken noodle soup, of course, good old standby. Hamburger soup, mac and cheese, but it's vegetarian. There's a lot of ingenuity that's going into the creation of the food that you serve. It's not just, you know, same old, same old.
We try.
You try.
I mean, in all honesty, sometimes the kids really enjoy the same old. And the other thing we found is that we've done surveys across the schools to try to, you know, weed some of the soups out that maybe the kids don't like as much. But there's so much variety between the schools that we serve food to that after doing all the surveys, we just basically realized there's not one single favorite that goes across all of the schools.
You just gave up and say, give them all the stuff.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, part of the program as well is to expose kids to new foods.
For sure.
So, yeah, it works
well,
that way too.
Well, your entrees are really an international potpourri. Buddha bowl, I presume that's got Chinese overtones. Chinese New Year dish, Japanese curry, shepherd's pie, which I suppose is an English standby. Burrito bowl, which would be Hispanic. Chicken and gelato, which is the same thing. Korma curry, which is India. Lasagna, Italian. Honestly, when I was reading this menu, I was starting to get hungry because you really cover such a lot of territory. When you have so much to do, obviously you need help, and getting volunteers is important. How much work do they do, and how many do you have, roughly speaking?
We definitely have, just for the school meal program, like I'd say between 20 and 25. I don't have an exact number. But volunteers are so amazing and important to the work we do. In all of our in-school programs that we have, they have volunteers every day. A lot of those volunteers commit to the whole year and come once a week or even more in order to make sure that the food is ready in time and to serve to the food. At Zest, we have volunteers as well. A lot of that is like, you know, chopping onions and peeling potatoes
vegetables.
And all of that kind of thing. But we do also have some volunteers that help us to deliver the food to the schools. And we have some volunteers that are also helping to serve the meals to the kids.
You know, these cooking programs, they have people chopping vegetables at like 90 miles an hour. They go bap, 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 like that. Do you have anybody like that among your volunteers? Are they normal people?
Yeah, most of us are normal. We did have one experience with Alex from Greencroft Farm. He helped us with our volunteer appreciation dinner last year, and we were watching him. He's chef trained. We were watching him cut vegetables, and I kind of joked and said, "Do you think you could do that with your eyes closed?" And he actually kind of like chuckled and shrugged and then closed his eyes and cut an entire onion with his eyes closed. So that was a bit terrifying to watch.
And no fingers were consumed
in
this.
No fingers.
Oh,
yeah.
Dear. Just to remind listeners once again that we have Mary Rodriguez, who is the school meals coordinator, and Melanie Bennett, the project and volunteer coordinator for the Shuswap Food Action Society. Now, one institution that really helps to back you up is the Zest Food Hub. How much of what you're doing relies on the Zest as a functional component for everything you're producing?
I mean, the Zest is the only space available right in Salmon Arm that has the commercial equipment that we can use in order to put these meals together. So yeah, of course, they're really important. It's such a great area because it has all of, like, for example, it has a chill blaster, which nobody, like a small business, a nonprofit, would never be able to afford something.
That's
like
something
that
chills food right away.
Yes. Like it can.
What does it do? How does it do that?
That would be a great question for Will, the Zest manager.
Yeah.
He knows a lot more about all the equipment. But even the steam kettles, I mean, we've applied for grants to get some of our own equipment so that we can increase production and just kind of like streamline our processes more. And like all of the equipment is, you know, in the $50,000 range. And that doesn't include like the venting, you know, to get it out of the building, which can be the same cost. So you're looking at almost $100,000 if you need a couple pieces of equipment. And we did have some fun at the auction that was happening locally and got some kitchen equipment from then. But the Zest is such a great place for so many startups and nonprofits.
Is that sort of kitchen, high volume kitchen equipment, widely available? I mean, you went to an auction. Was that a place where you could go regularly and find that kind of stuff? Or was this just a good luck? Lucky break.
Yeah, that was actually something that someone had pointed out to us. Spencer actually had let us know that the auction was happening. So that was my first experience with an online auction. It was a bit stressful.
Oh, it's online.
Yeah, it was online. And also for us, like, you know, my background is in social sciences. So trying to figure out which equipment from an auction might be appropriate and does it work and all of those questions, like, it's really above what I know. So we've been really fortunate that we've had a lot of cooks who've like lent us their time and like Will, who's given us his expertise as well, so that we've been able to kind of get the insider knowledge on that before we make purchases.
Melanie, you've been around long enough to see the pre-Zest and post-Zest worlds. What impact has the Zest had on food systems in this area, generally speaking?
Well, we would be hampered by what we could do. And it, you know, it comes down to, like, Serena had done an assessment of schools, you know, years ago, and it was like, you know, which schools even have kitchens? Which schools have kitchens that would be large enough to be able to produce for the amount? So, you know, there was already assessments made, and it is lacking, really. There's just really not enough. I think, I don't know if this is true, but it would be really great to have more in-house cooks in schools rather than all the transport.
Sure,
because the investment in some of like the items that we need just to simply transport the soup and casseroles are also incredible investments.
So Mary, right now, each school functions a little bit differently. They all have their own facilities or not facilities, or what's the sort of breakdown? Is it some have, some don't? How many have something that you can offer for this kind of thing, doing things in-house?
I know that there's about 25 schools in the school district. Now that Serena is working with the school district, she's done a lot of work to make sure that all the schools have like at least a fridge, for example. There were some areas that you drop off that didn't even have that. I mean, same with the stoves and the ovens. There's some schools now who have multiple, but right, if you're serving, you know, 100, 150 kids and you have one stove, right, that's when things get quite tricky. So it is really hard. Like, we have three schools that do have school meal programs, but it's kind of the combination of you need enough students in the school so that you can keep the cost low and also pay someone to be in the school to cook. And then, yeah, do they have the kitchen facility? So I do have to say we do have some really amazing cooks in schools that have been very, very creative in their use of, like, you know, rice cookers, Instapots, plug-in skillets in order to produce large volumes of food with very minimal equipment and supplies.
Flying by the seat of your pants.
And then you plan your recipes accordingly and you make it work.
Yeah, for sure. Over the summer, what will you be doing with respect to the school food program? What, I mean, there's obviously stuff going to happen in the summer.
Mm-hmm. It's predominantly admin and just planning to make sure we have everything for the next year. The fun activities that Mel talked about as far as, you know, procedures and, like, you know, there's lots of fun that could be had there. And then as well, we work with a lot of different farmers. Like, some we have asked specifically to grow, you know, X amount of pounds of different crops for us. And then once those become available, then usually we do a big call out for volunteers and we'll head down to Zest and process, you know, hundreds of pounds of corn or, you know, do a lot of garlic in a day, different things like that. So that by the time we start back up in the fall, our freezers will be packed with all of these wonderful things that are only available for a short season in the summer.
Indeed, seasonal food. That's what you really find out when it grows next door to you. Melanie, what are you going to be doing over the summer yourself? I mean, the summer doesn't end for you. You don't have this kind of season, you know, related to the school year. You just carry on. Let's start with some obvious things. Project Grow, which we're still talking about young people, and it's really involving a lot of young people. It's changed. It's expanding. It's two groups now.
Yeah, two age groups. We had it 9 to 12 for the last 2 years, but we had people saying like, oh, my younger sibling, or they would have loved to have done
my
this.
My brother did this.
Yeah,
can I do
and
it
I mean,
too?
And then at 12, like, there's still kids that who were 12 who could still definitely garden. So we just decided, let's expand. And so that way Jasmine and I are working together. So Jasmine is taking on the older youth, 11 to 14, and then I'm taking on the 8 to 10 year olds. We're calling them sprouts. We're really happy.
Course.
We have 50 kids signed up. Almost all of them, I think, are going the distance. And that just means basically that they have made a garden plan. They submit their image, and then they go and pick up their seeds and plants, and they're going to grow their garden. Whether they go all the way to the end, that is yet to be seen, but they all seem pretty keen. They submit pictures, they take photos, they put them into, we have these top secret folders online that only they have access to. And then we get to see their journey. Cause that's a big part of it, is just seeing that they are doing this independently. This year, my own kids are in here too. So I am getting a good learning curve on how much you do have to encourage and entice the kids to get out there, get planting, get weeding. So I have a lot of respect for the parents who are also supporting the kids to do this.
What kind of prizes are you offering? That's also something that's changed over time.
Yeah. So this year we're excited that we are going to do our award ceremony as part of the Downtown Farmers Market. So it's going to be September 13th.
Okay.
And this way too, you know, with the fair moving towards August, and whether they do that long term, I don't know, but it was really early to be judging and doing the award ceremony for a garden. So this is able to push us into September. So now we can actually go see the gardens at the end of August, beginning of September, when they're like really at their peak.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll choose the winner, which is so hard. Top three gardens in the youth division. Those are some significant RESPs. So that's from Saskew has contributed to that. And there's a $2,000 RESP for the top prize, then $1,500. Now I should say this, the registration closes today on May 30th.
Listeners,
no, May 31st.
If you have somebody in either of the two age groups, please call in today.
If somebody wanted to squeak in, I'm sure we can talk about it. So yeah, like those are significant prizes for some of the youth. And I always thought that it was actually the parents who'd be more motivated by that, but I've heard back from some of the parents and it's actually the youth are motivated by the RESP.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of kids these days are anxious about what's going to happen when they leave
school. I think so.
And I think that's playing into it. I'm sure it is.
And then for the sprouts, you know, they're not going to be necessarily that interested in RESPs. So 8 to 10 year olds, what we did was we approached businesses that kids would like. So Sanctuary Games was all over. They're like, absolutely, gave a bunch of gift cards, you know, Sport Check and Buckingham Palace. We have, I'm going to forget some names right now.
Oh, that's okay. We got a pretty good idea.
It's all on our website. We encourage people to go to our website and have a look. And I also want to make sure I say too, like, Buckerfields has been such an incredible partner. Tony, you know, she's such an advocate and she loves this contest too. So Buckerfields and West Coast Seeds this year, actually, they really stepped up and they donated almost all of the seeds.
Wow. I looked at the pictures from last year and I don't know how you chose, how the judges chose which were the best, because there were just amazing walls of you know, pea vines growing up, you know, various kinds of stands and things, and just very rich.
Yeah, it's great. And the parents love it too.
Is there a size limit for the gardens?
We just basically say any, like a 4x8 bed, you know, a standard garden bed is your minimum. You know, after that, or anything less than that, it just really doesn't compete.
Right.
But I mean, certainly that could be a number of pots and planters on a patio. And so what we do is we've broken it down into point system, and we have all of our criteria, and everything is based on, you know, 1 out of 5 or 0 to 5, 0 to 15. The size of the garden is actually one of the lowest criteria, because we don't want that to be a factor.
Sure.
But certainly the health of the plants, the creativity, the understanding of growth habits. So like, do they have a plan for trellising or a tomato cage? Have they done the learning? Also, that's what we want to see. And that's a large part of the point system.
Do you see a little light going on in the eyes of the children who are involved in the contest as they get engaged in? There's more people this year, right? So mm-hmm. obviously the word's getting out in the street. But do you see changes in them as the years go by, or this year goes on? They kind of get
it's really great that we have kids who have been in past years. They've signed back up. So I really like that. You know, I just had a class at the teaching garden, and some of our youth gardeners came, and they're keen. Like, they're happy to do this. They want to do this. So my kids, they're pretty excited. I do have to do a bit of prompting. But when they're in there, they're working hard. They're really good at doing it.
That's wonderful. Okay. Another thing that is sort of linked and now increasingly linked actually to the school food program, because it's producing some food for the school food program, is the teaching garden. Teaching Garden has been going for a while now. It's
10th season.
10th season. Yeah. I remember driving by the first time. I couldn't find it. Yeah. But now it's very unmissable. It's really pretty impressive.
It is. I was there the other day, or actually the other evening, and I just looked at it and I was like, wow, it has never looked better. Mm-hmm. It looks amazing right now. And that's volunteers, Sue Elmery, you know, Rita Greger, she's a Rotarian here. She brings people. They are determined to get every single weed out of that garden.
Mary, do you ever hear kids at school talking to some of these about some of these other programs? I mean, now that there is some, I think it's what, tomatoes are going to be supplied to the Super Meals program. Do you ever hear kids, do they know about this teaching garden where all sorts of wonderful things happen?
I'm not sure. I definitely have put it forward to some of the classes when we're in with cooking classes. To be honest, normally when we're in a school, it's such a fast and furious pace once again, because, you know, the kids might have 20 minutes to eat. So it's not like you're able to like sit down and have this great conversation with each student. It's more like bun, carrot stick, soup, like, you know, just like handing everything out. So
assembly lines.
Yeah, pretty much.
I don't know if kids really do know about it, to be honest. But we love having kids come up. So we had Cubs recently, we had Girl Guides come up, we had the Children's Association, Storefront School might come up. So when they do come, they have a great time. Like, we really enjoy it. And I love having kids up there.
Yeah, I've seen crowds of kids up there. It seems to be a bit of a magnet. Sue is working on a seed saving garden. What's that? Is that a special little plot in the corner somewhere where things that are growing could be?
Yeah, it's a section of the garden. So it's the seeds of the shoe swap. That's what she's selling it as. So, which is great. So she's sold some at seed swaps and at the farmer's market. And those proceeds actually go to help support the garden. And so she's really knowledgeable about saving seed. And she says there is no food security without seed security. So for her, it's really neat to go and see it, because, you know, she took cabbages out of the ground last year, took them out, roots and all, stored them in a cold cellar for the winter. Come spring, she replanted them. So they're just ugly things, right? Coming out of the ground and going back into the ground, I should say. But now we're actually seeing them come back to life. And in 2 months or so, they're going to send out a seed stalk. And I've never seen a cabbage sprout seeds. I've seen lots of other things sprout seed, but not a cabbage. So it's a really interesting learning curve for us too.
Wow, that's sort of expanding a real year-round cycle.
Oh, absolutely. And peppers and even squash, she will now. So with a pepper that she wants to keep the seeds from, she'll put it in mesh so that it's completely protected from any cross-pollination, because those peppers will cross with hot peppers and she doesn't want that. So she knows she's going to protect that. And with the squash, she's going to hand-pollinate them and then protect that particular squash so that that blossom doesn't get cross-pollinated. So she's got a plan. We're going to have signs. And then Elle Marie has her permaculture garden. And we got some signs printed this year that will actually explain the 12 principles. So she's really excited to showcase those actually this Saturday.
Just remind listeners once again that we have Mary Rodriguez, who is the school meals coordinator, and Melanie Bennett, the project and volunteer coordinator for the Shushaw Food Action Society. You're also working more directly with Second Harvest to make sure that the link between what you produce in the garden goes there more effectively. How's that working?
We always have conversations. It's all about relationships in our community, right? Whether it's school meals and talking to the farmers and what can you do? How can we work together? This is the same with Second Harvest. How do we make this as easy as possible for volunteers? I think so much of what we're doing is how do we make sure that this is really easy?
Right.
And for Second Harvest, I mean, they are so busy. If you talk to Val, you know, from years ago to 250 people going through, now they're at like 750 people going through. The demand is exponentially grown, right?
You know, I just want to pause for a moment and say that for me, the fact that there has to be a Second Harvest is a sign that the system really isn't working as well as it should. I mean, I appreciate the work they do. It's wonderful work. They're really making a difference in a lot of people's lives. And they're serving fresh. They're making available fresh stuff, not just tin cans and
fresh,
stuff.
Yeah.
But the idea that more and more people would be accessing that kind of backup as opposed to being able to get food directly in the usual fashion, you know, go to the market and buy some food and that kind of thing. It's worrisome. It's a worrisome trend as far as I see. And we've had a lot of guests on the show who've talked about that. The fact that the support system for people who do not have enough money to buy really decent food has expanded because they're being left out. They're being marginalized. And it isn't the right way to do it.
Actually had a lady come up. We were at the teaching garden this morning. I don't know what happened. It was like a beacon was going off. We had like 12 people there on a Wednesday. It was really strange. And this lady, she lives in the area and she stopped by. She said she often does. She just likes to take a look. And she actually didn't really know that there was this connection with Second Harvest. So we talked about it. We talked about Second Harvest and what's happening and the fresh food going down there and how, you know, the fact that it's fresh food is a real difference. And I like how Second Harvest does this, where people can kind of just come in. They're trying to change that stigma to it's not a food bank, it's a community market. Mm. So a Salvation Army, they're trying to change those words, right? And people can go in and they can choose what they want. So there's that sort of sovereignty to your choice. Yep. But the fresh produce is totally different than getting it's like week old produce that's been sort of sitting. And how much of a difference can that make to people's health and vitality so that they can then go forward in the community and do good things too? But just that the need is there. And this is what we can do. I know it's too bad that it has to be. I don't know what else we're going to do. But the fact is that this is what we can do. We can't control mortgage rates. We can't control BC Hydro prices, but we can grow food for our community.
You know, and I think it also means we learn to be more responsive to those in the community who need help. We don't just sit in our, you know, comfortable residence and look around and say everything's fine because it's fine for us. We start to notice that there are people in the community who are in need.
And these are families, and these are families with kids. And it's the same thing with the school meal programs. The need is there to provide them with nourishing school meals. And that's what we're doing.
Speaking of which, Mary, you took a trip to the Cowichan Valley not so long ago with Serena, I believe.
Yep, Serena and also Liz, our executive director.
Liz Blakeway. What were you looking for and what did you find?
So Nourish has been operating for twice as long as we have, and they are an amazing group, Fatima, Allison, and Kendall. And
did you meet them, by the way? Those are the three
we
founders.
We did, yes. We were able to go in. We worked with them. Serena and I were able to be there for 2 days, and then my daughter and I actually went back and did a third day with them just to sort of experience their different programs. It was during a bit of a lull for them since it was spring break, so they weren't as busy as they normally would be. But all three of them are trained chefs, and so they just it was great. So they had so much insight, and they do a lot of different meal programs there. They actually have a contract with the school district, so they provide breakfast, lunch, and I believe one or two snacks a day for all of the schools in the district. And they're able to offer like a huge variety of things. So we were fortunate that they shared some of their recipes with us, which was really great. We've tried to incorporate that into some of our breakfast programs. And yeah, they're just such a wonderful group of people.
I looked a little bit of the history of Nourish Cowichan, that's the full name. And they started with a single project in one school, breakfast in one school, and they cooked the food in Fatima's restaurant kitchen.
Yeah, that's right.
So it was pretty low level, you might say, or a small scale. And then they got into a partnership arrangement with School District 79, that's the district there. And then they went zest, but they did it in their own way. They took an old metal shop belonging to a French-Canadian school, or a school with a French-Canadian name, in Duncan, and it converted into food prep facility, and it took a couple of years. Did you go through that facility?
Yeah, that's
it must
where
be
we
pretty.
Were. Yeah, it was great. That's where we were working out of. And it's amazing because they're actually right in a school. They even have an open door policy. So the back door is open and kids can come in at any time. And there's like snacks and muffins and sandwiches and stuff that they just leave at the back door. And like they talk about the relationships they've even built with the kids coming through, where they'll come and they have a sit down space there. So the kids will sit on the couch and they'll start telling them all about, you know, things going on in their personal life. And it sounds like it's such a lovely space. It really gave us something to sort of dream towards, you know.
Now they number 70 volunteers, 1,800 children last year, 3,000 children this year planned, 23 schools. They've gone up from one to 23. And it's not costing the school district anything. Now, how is that? We're going to talk about funding in a little bit while, but what is the source of funding that made the school district get off free?
I think that's one of the reasons that we were actually drawn to them, is that they do receive money through the Feeding Futures program as well, but that's actually quite a small portion of their budget. A lot of it comes from community members. They have people that fundraise for them. They have people that there's a radiothon, sorry if I said that wrong, that happens
right.
Every year. And it brings in a ton of money for them. So she said that at the beginning with their new space, they had so many events where they were just really getting their name out there and just encouraging people to come in and see what they're doing and work with them and try to create funds that way. They were so inventive in what they were doing. They even had one of their fundraisers, a volunteer took on, was they had custom-made Christmas trees for businesses. And so the volunteer would come in and like decorate Christmas trees and the businesses would buy them. And then at the end of the year, you know, they'd take the tree back and then they'd sell it to them again the next year. But they were just so inventive in the ways that they fundraised. They had lots of tea parties and dinners that they hosted. So having a space and being able to do something like that, like, would be an amazing thing to work towards in the future.
So this remodeled metal shop, now a food prep facility, is not just a food preparation facility. It's also a space for people to gather, people to socialize. Maybe do they have meetings in it when they have meetings, or do they have a separate place for that?
Yeah, so it's quite a long room, and they have, like, when you first walk in the door, well, I should say as well, actually, they have a beautiful garden outside. They have volunteers and also I think a paid staff member that runs it, but they grow, I think she said they grew 1,000 pounds of tomatoes out of their garden last year for their program. So it is a smaller space that was donated by, I believe it's like a condo sort of unit that's behind their space. And they just said, hey, there's this lawn here. We kind of sick of mowing it and nobody's using it, and they gave them the space to use as a garden. So it's amazing. When you first walk in the door, you kind of have like the whole baking area and lots of prep tables, and then behind that you have things where they're doing more of like the entrees. There's a sitting area, there's office space in there, and then they have a full separate kitchen. So all the volunteers that are there during the day, they make a separate meal for them and everybody sits down and has lunch together. So that's the space that they're also able to rent out. I think they've had like different groups that sort of want a meal made for them so they can go in, use their space, they'll cook the meal, and then they'll just walk out and leave and let them have their event and then come back at the end and clean up.
The school district has been very cooperative with them. They passed a special resolution to, you know, work with the Nourish Cowichan people. Melanie, how has the school district worked with you guys here? Because it's there's some parallels there.
Yeah, so Serena, you know, having started everything, working directly with, you know, the principals and superintendent and building those relationships, again, it's building those relationships And then the choice to move from a position in Shoe Shop Food Action to become the school district Feeding Futures coordinator, that was all, you know, quite strategic too. And that just gave Serena, you know, the real true inside scoop on what's happening. Because, you know, for Food Action, we were just focused on a few schools, the schools that could, we could do this in, whether it was Jackson because they had a kitchen. And, you know, so we did what we could. But then finding out that we could, you know, how can we branch out? And that was, you know, Serena was really integral to being in that position.
And now she's working for the school.
And now, so she's working with the school district.
One of the things that underlies the program here and the program in Cowichan is a set of values. And the values really seem to me to be pretty high-minded. One thing that inspires the values is the fact that Canada is the only G7 country without a universal school food program. And that's like an invitation to ingenuity and doing all sorts of things to make that not happen. One of the couple of things that are on the website for Nourish Cowichan, every child deserves access to nutritious food for a healthy life and academic success. Free, nutritious school meals help all families, regardless of barriers or income. How does that sit with you, Mary, in terms of just feeling that you're doing the right thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I came from a family that was food insecure when I was growing up, so it really means a lot to me to be able to work in an area where we're also helping to support other families and other kids that might need, you know, a bit of extra healthy food for their lunch. People go through challenging times in their life. It doesn't mean that they're always going to participate in the program or always need to. Hopefully they'd always want to, but by making them universal and having that option available is wonderful. I think like with the statement that you just read from Nourish, I mean, that's wonderful. Fatima is from Mozambique originally. And so she sort of brings like the knowledge and sort of a different cultural element to it. And she's just this fierce powerhouse kind of lady who, is not afraid to stand up and say the things that need to be said. And, she's very inspiring. I have a lot to learn to get to that point, but she has no problem fighting for something that she believes in. And I think that's amazing.
You know, I think a lot of people coming to this country have lived in parts of the world where moving ahead and expressing your values in living out your dreams is a real challenge. You don't, when people don't like what you're doing, they can be much more ferocious than happens here. I think that means that you're hardened up when you get here. You're kind of willing to stand knowing they're not going to shoot you. They're not going to, you know, chastise you physically. They're going to just say, oh, well, we're not interested in yet. And you say, well, okay, well, you will be soon. We're going to make it happen.
We're standing up for kids, you know.
Yes.
That's ferociously standing up for kids at this point. You know, and you mentioned too, like, no matter the income or anything like that, sometimes I know it feels like, you know, maybe you just want to support the kids that need the financial support, but you can have a lot of money and still not eat well either. Or you can have a lot of money and have foods available to your kids and they may not want to eat it. And so this positive food culture that's also trying to be created through all of this is going to have beneficial impacts on all demographics. Mm. And if we can create even just that positive impact on food choices now moving, you know, that's such a tremendous benefit for kids moving forward. Same with giving them gardening skills. That it's going to imprint on there and they might step away from it for a while, but they're going to come back in their, you know, 20s and 30s and say, I knew how to do that. I'd like to get back to that.
Yeah. I've had a number of people on Food Conversations who have said exactly that. They had gardens when they were kids and they went off and did a whole bunch of other things, you know, mechanical engineering or, you know, town planning or something. And then they said, well, we're going to get our hands in the dirt. We want to feel that we're participating directly in producing food and other things that we use ourselves. Just to remind listeners once again that we have Mary Rodriguez, who is the school meals coordinator, and Melanie Bennett, the project and volunteer coordinator for the Shoe Shop Food Action Society. On the website, in addition, there's also from the World Health Organization, the 5 A's of food security, which are availability, accessibility, adequacy, you know, food is nutritious and safe and environmentally sustainable. Acceptability, meaning it's not food that you don't like to eat or you never did eat or you've never seen before. And then the ultimate one, agency, which means that there's power invested in a community to take steps to achieve the other goals. Why don't you just ruminate? Just let me know what these names mean to you, Melanie. What does it conjure up in your mind when you hear those kinds of things?
Well, the agency part. I mean, that's why we keep saying the food secure shoe swap. You know, we have the capacity here, and that's why we want to support farmers. We want, you know, land to remain farmed and not sit idle. We want to have the ability to feed ourselves if highways are shut down. So a food secure shoe swap is one of the goals in all of this. So that ability to be able to pull upon the foods that we can grow here so that they're nice and ripe and nutritious, so that they are affordable, available, number one, available, that they are adequate, that we have enough here. We will not have enough here if we don't have farmers. So yeah, I mean, they all play well together.
And the number of farmers that are coming in here who are not from farming families, they are people, a lot of them young, who just want to make a difference in a constructive way. And the other thing is they can go on the internet and learn about a lot of the things to do, the arcane secrets of a trade like being a farmer or a business, whatever, running a business. That's something that's really changed. I don't think we've quite come to understand how that is. Mary, when you're looking at seeing what young people are doing, you must sense that they, some of them anyway, explore far beyond what they need to learn in their immediate school environment. They get captivated a little bit by the food program, and then they start to look further beyond it.
I mean, I think that the part that comes to mind when you're talking about that, you know, we can look up all this information and do all this research, but I think it's sometimes the hands-on learning that's missing, right? So the opportunities that Mel has up at the Teaching Garden with Elmarie and Sue, those are opportunities where people can actually go and they can learn about the weather that we have here and the soil that might be in their backyard, you know? So it's a lot different. Like, you can go online, and I mean, I do this as well. You see all these beautiful pictures and different vegetables growing, but that might not be suitable for our climate. So I think the hands-on learning is really, really important. And we find that as well in cooking classes that we do in the schools. You know, you'll go in and some kids have done a lot of cooking at home and they're super proud and showing the other kids like the right way to cut an onion or to peel garlic or whatnot. And, you know, you walk in, we had a cooking class the other day where a boy was like, I've never used a knife before. And I mean, it's a bit terrifying when you're about to like hand that over and let them cut vegetables. But at the same time, like, that student had such a great time. And I hope that once again, that's like something that maybe they would take home and show an interest in, or continue in the future. Like, when kids help to cook food or they help to grow food, they're way more invested in it. And I think that that's like such a beautiful thing for them to take into the future.
I need a lesson. What's the proper way to cut an onion?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I think it's one of, I don't think there's a right way to do it. You
I
know?
Don't know. My daughter puts on swim goggles. Yeah. She comes out with like tinted swim goggles on when she's about to cut an onion.
Yeah.
Open the window.
There's different.
Cover the container where the cut onions is.
Or come to Zest and peel and cut so many onions that your eyes are not sensitive to it any longer.
Didn't we have one volunteer whose husband said you can't go and do garlic anymore?
She basically was told she had to get home and remove every single item that was in the kitchen before she was allowed to enter.
Oh my goodness. Relationships being challenged by onions and garlic.
Yeah.
Well, let's just divert for a second to a few sort of short snappers, as they used to call, and reach for the top. The food forest, it's changed its layout. It's changed its focus a little bit. Melanie, what's happening there?
Yeah, the Salvation Army, they, you know, they've got some really key new staff who are just really keen to take a lot of ownership of it. But the key thing is this year is that they have plans to expand the cafe. And so half of the food forest was removed because they're actually making space to expand the building. So that's why that all happened. But they still want to see like that they have the food growing outside. They enjoy that process and the concept of it for sure. We have kind of stepped back a little bit because they do have their staff and volunteers, and we're really happy to see that it's still going.
The John McLeod Memorial Garden, it's almost like an adult food, food grow contest, or for families, a family-based, you know, it's not a contest, but How's that coming along?
Well, I mean, when you go in there and you look at different people, I'm sure are kind of going around to each other's garden beds going, wow, that one looks really good. Oh, look at all their germination. I was just there today. I was working in the very hot sun because we're trying to finish up some projects. And so for this year, we are keeping things as they are. We're not expanding it this year. And so it was just more about finishing some projects, which included.
But
just,
you have a script subscription list and it's a bit overprescribed.
Yeah, we have about six people who are outside of just the gardeners there, but we actually have about half the gardeners there who would like a second bed. So it looks great. You know, everybody's still really happy to be there. And I just was, you know, being there today after the rain that we had on Sunday, like so much explosive growth, pollinator garden is all growing in, the peas are climbing up the fence. So the communal beds, you know, one of the things about it too, is that yes, there's a fence and fences are important. It's true. But we also are growing things on the fence line. So the people who are walking by could certainly go over and pop a cherry tomato in their mouth, pick a cucumber off the fence. Absolutely.
It's a wonderful thing to do. I remember that as a child being one of the great pleasures of going to a plant and picking something off and eating it right away. Now, the farmer's market, and we talk about the farmers. It's very successful and it's well attended and all. Do either of you go to the farmer's market? Mary?
I do. I didn't so much in the past because I was working at a different farmer's market that was the same day and the same time. But yes, I love to go down there. I do have to say, though, one of the things that I'm a bit spoiled with in doing the school meal programs is that we purchase from, it's actually over 30 farmers in our area. So often I'll actually just get my items at the same time that we're picking up from the school so that I don't have to be there every Saturday. But yeah, I mean, it's such a lovely place to go. And, you know, you see so many familiar faces and you stop and chat, which is great and good and bad because you're meant to be there for 5 minutes and like an hour later, you're still standing there talking to like a vendor or someone else that you've run into. But I think that's also one of like the amazing and beautiful things about the farmer's market.
It brings out a kind of an atmosphere, creates an atmosphere that is really quite amiable. Melanie, do you ever go down just to hang out? I know you do because I've seen
I
you there.
I do at times. And I, you know, regretfully, I don't go down as much as I probably should because I'm the one who writes the post saying, support your local farmers. I mean, I guess in a sense, I would say I'm kind of a local farmer for myself. I grow a lot of my own produce, so I don't actually need to really go buy much. I certainly go down for my bags of coffee. I don't bake, so I will usually hit up the bakers. And yeah, I like to take my kids down there from time to time too, but they're the same. It's like, okay, do we want to go with mom? Because it's going to be an hour, because inevitably there will be great conversations.
Children know exactly what their parents are doing, and they judge. They pass judgment.
They go and buy the ginger snap cookies. I give them some money, and they're usually very happy.
Yeah, and so Hudson, he goes to Marcus, and he buys a pretzel. And then if I'm talking for too long, then he goes back, and he gets another pretzel.
So he judges the visit to the farmer's market by how many pretzels he had to eat in order to keep his mother from having to worry about him. The Sunday sessions at Buckerfields, they're ongoing, a whole range of stuff. Interesting, one I just highlighted is Kevin Smith coming and talking about biochar, because biochar is now being produced locally. It's an ancient carbon-based soil amendment that was thought at first to be just sort of accidentally in the soil until somebody actually explored the Amazon basin and noticed that it was actually being produced deliberately by farmers and supported a very large civilization in the Amazon basin, which was, again, neglected. But now it's come back. Biochar is, I believe you got some in your garden.
Oh, yeah. Mel. We used a whole bunch. We've used it everywhere.
And did you get any to the
We have it in the teaching garden beds. We have it at the McLeod garden beds. I have it in my own beds.
Well, I confess that I did buy a large cubic meter of it because it seemed like such a good idea. I've known about it for 20 years, but it was never available here. And just to see it being widely used and seeing how the possibility of using a natural soil enhancement that adds carbon to the soil, which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Sunday sessions, this was its third season. We actually moved it over to the Agricultural Association building this season, purely because I had some grand visions of maybe doing some more hands-on classes where there was a little bit more space in their room. And there's a kitchen. So I had grand visions that there would be more hands-on things. It didn't necessarily work out exactly like that, but that's okay. We can, you know, that's the beautiful thing, try new things. But the education and the caliber of educators, people who know about a subject in this community, is really impressive. And so, like Mary was saying, you can learn all kinds of things online, but I think it really makes a difference when you're hearing it from people who have experience, who can actually talk firsthand about it, that you can ask questions to. I think that's a really huge thing. Who can talk about your particular area, your region, and just also, I think, committing yourself to showing up and going. Because you can say, I want to do this year, and never get around to it. But if you're like, I'm going to go to the class, then you are more inclined. You're going to learn it, and then hopefully you are then going to go and do it.
It's much easier to do when you have an idea of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Finally, we should probably talk about the AGM and summer solstice yes. potluck, because it's coming up on June 18th.
Yeah, so we're going to, like last year, actually, we're doing a bit of a repeat because we really liked it. We like to focus on the seasons for food because, I mean, there's so much variation that happens in that quarterly part of the year. And summer is an amazing time when so much fresh stuff is up. So the summer solstice salad bowls is the theme of the potluck. We are going to be providing the base grains, local meat. We'll provide, you know, the base of these bowls. And so like the Buddha bowl you were saying, that's the sort of concept of taking that base layer and then just adding all the things that you love on top and like really good dressings and just creating your own delicious, fresh, super nourishing bowl. And so we'll have a gathering, a potluck, and we're going to do it at the Ag Association again. So that's down there at the log building where the John McLeod Garden is. Beautiful outside space. We'll do the social and eat together, and then we'll go inside for our AGM. And we hope everybody will stay, of course. And, you know, the goal of that is to listen to all these great things that we're doing, but then, like, let's talk about the future. Let's talk about the visions and get feedback from the community, too.
You know, often we end the show by talking about sort of trends and where things are going. But frankly, I think you've done a very good job of saying they're going like this. They're expanding as my hands move farther apart. It's a demonstration of what's really happening on all the projects that you're involved with. It's more a question of trying to corral and contain that new energy and this new expanded production system that you guys have got in place. It's really been great having both of you here, Mary and Melanie. Thank you so much for being with us today. On we go.
On we go. Go to our website, shuswapfood.ca, so that you can see all of this information.
Anyway, lovely having you here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.